Welcome to the Vitruvian Human Podcast.
An exploration of body, mind, and soul through the vessels of art, science, and spirituality.
What if our entire purpose here was to embark on a quest to understand our place in the cosmos?
Greetings, curious humans, and welcome to episode 5 of the Vitruvian Human Podcast, the quest to understand our place in the cosmos with an uncensored exploration of body, mind, and soul through the vessels of art, science, and spirituality. Joining you on this journey are your two podcast hosts, Chris Ferris and Maylene Joy. If you would like to know more about me and everything that I do, including Continuum, my online community of like-minded spirit seekers, you can go to chrisferris.com. To find out more about Maylene and her holistic wellness business, which offers yoga and holistic counseling both online and in person, you can go to MayleneJoy.com. Our next very special guest is a multifaceted meditation and breathwork coach. Founder of two highly successful wellness businesses, Calmably and Reconnect Meditation, she inspires a broad range of people across multiple levels, from corporate functions and large-scale gatherings to personalized one-on-one sessions. A true example of someone embodying the very practices that she teaches, she aims to always bring her most authentic self to any situation, and supports others to do the same with elegant and profound words of wisdom, such as why being yourself is the only skill you will ever need. Ahead of us is a deeply honest and upfront conversation with her about her own quest to understand her place in the cosmos. It is with great pleasure that we introduce Burr Tan. Well, the time is flying by. We're already up to episode 5 of the Vitruvian Human Podcast. And with us today is a very special guest. We have Burr Tan speaking with us. Burr, how you doing?
I'm good. I'm nervous.
That's good. So we are too. So it's okay.
Yeah. And I'm grateful. Really grateful.
Well, we are grateful to have you with us today.
Thank you.
And we've got my partner in crime, Maylene Joy.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the podcast. And I'm really excited for our guest on the show today. I've really been looking forward to this podcast.
So, Burr, in our brief meeting in person that we have that we had not so long ago, I have to admit that even though your vivacious personality and your infectious energy was a great experience to be around, your work and your reputation actually precedes you, because I had heard about the meditation and yoga with baby animals for I think even a couple of years before I actually got to meet you. And then looking up everything else you do, it seems like you've got a range of talents, from meditation and yoga to breath work and even now online raves on Facebook. Would you be able to, for our listeners and viewers, just give a bit of background about yourself?
Yeah, sure. So roughly about 6 years ago, I went to a meditation camp, and it's called a retreat, but it's more like a boot camp. It's 10 days of silent meditation. So there's no talking, no tech, no exercise. And you're meditating for 10 hours a day. You don't eat after 12. And yeah. And that completely changed everything. Up until that point, I was always in my head, couldn't stop thinking, overanalyzing. I couldn't really feel what was going on in my life or how I felt about anything. Like you said, like I'm really vivacious and happy, right? But then it was like back then it was different. It was like a constant all the time. So a consistent denying of anything that I perceived to be negative. And that was very, very painful.
Mm. Right. So just blocking out everything that you kind of felt like if you just keep going and just focus on all the positives all the time, then life would be okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was like a super overachieving cheerleader, like yeah. And it was a beautiful part of my journey, and it was also what was keeping me crushingly sad.
Wow.
Yeah.
Nice contrast.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Visual too, that kind of, what was the visual you used with the cheerleader?
Super overachieving cheerleader.
Yeah. I like visuals like that because it's kind of like an archetype that we can see of that type of persona. And it's so clear that underneath it was like you kind of knew there was more to this. And so what I'm curious about is with the 10-day meditation, is that Vipassana?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So I've experienced Vipassana once and I came out of it describing it like psychotherapy on steroids. And so what I'm curious about with your 10-day journey with Vipassana, was there a turning point? Because you said that was kind of 6 years ago, that was the beginning of you getting out of your head. So during the actual 10 days, what was the turning point for you? Or was it after?
Yeah. Am I allowed to swear on the podcast?
Absolutely.
Oh, yes. Okay, good. So so I will tell you the story. So yes, in answer to your question, there was definitely a turning point. It was between day 6 and 8, and I can't remember. And Chris, you've been on the Vipassana retreat before as well, hey?
I've been on some pretty intense journeys in my life, and that is still an unknown for me.
Cool.
That's still another frontier.
Awesome. Yeah, so, well, Maylene, you'll remember, it was quite not at all what I expected, because I'd thought that meditation, I don't know, I think I'd gone in like thinking that it would be super relaxing, and I didn't know much about it other than what I just said, but I still thought on some level that it would be relaxing. I'm not sure why. And then it was day 3, and I remember my back was getting super strong, and I was feeling really happy about that because I was like, oh, well, you know, I still can't stop overthinking, still can't really feel anything. So if I come out of this with like a really strong lower back, I'll be really happy. And then it was between day 6 and day 8 that it actually created something. So I was sitting behind this woman, and at the end of every day, you're allowed to talk to the teacher for 5 minutes and just ask them any questions. And I was sitting behind her, and for context, again, I hadn't really done any meditation on my own before that, aside from out of a book. So I didn't have any understanding of consciousness, the universe. Wasn't a vegetarian. And I was sitting behind this chick, and she was talking to the teacher, and she's like, oh my God, like, and she's so much emotion in her voice. You know, I was like meditating in my room, and I couldn't stop crying all of a sudden. I felt like I was going to be sick. And she's just like, you know, talking through all this stuff. Then I was sitting behind her, and I was like, what a fucking hippie. I was like, that is never going to happen to me. And then, like, I just, you know, the meditation finished, and then I went back to my room, and I literally got through, like, the first half of this sentence. The sentence was, I wonder if this will happen to me. And I got to, like, I wonder if that, and then, like, I just had this full visceral body reaction of, like, everything is coming, and it was, like, this, like, buzzing cloud on the edge of my peripheral, and it was, like, and I was, like, holy shit, like, I feel like I'm going to be sick. And I started crying. And I was really, really scared, but also really excited, because I was like, oh my God, this is all the shit from my childhood that I've known has always been there, but I've been too afraid to actually feel. And so I like let it come through me. And then I like remember this like pivotal moment where it just went like a big, like just a hood or something. And then I was like, and I was like, back in my like little 12-year-old self. And so when I was 12, so I always had a really weird relationship with my stepdad, but when I was 12, he crossed the line. So it was sexual abuse, and he crossed it then. And yeah, and it just took me way back to there. And I was like experiencing everything as if it was occurring at that moment. And it wasn't like I'd suppressed it. It was just like I refused to feel it. I acknowledged the experience that happened, but I didn't feel it until then. And then I was feeling it all. And it was like you said, psychotherapy on crack. It was just like so much grief and fear, and then clearing, and the space that it created in me was incredible. I was sporadically going between like extreme like grief to like just levels of like happiness and clarity and joy that I didn't know existed. It was like it just cleared all the shit out, and then I could really feel like who I was and why I was and my connection with the universe and the world and everything. And yeah, that was the turning point, the first turning point in Vipassana.
Wow.
Oh, goosebumps.
Yeah.
Wow. I felt like I was really there with you as you're explaining that real visceral feeling. And then the way you described those polarities, those extremes of the grief, and then that euphoria.
Yeah.
I find that so fascinating. And so yeah. That was the first turning point for you. And then after leaving the, I was going to say retreat, but it's really not a retreat. It is, yeah, like you said, it's a boot camp.
Mm.
After leaving that, I mean, what were you doing at that time in your life with your occupation? And then how did you then unfold into the last 6 years to where you are now?
So at the time, I was a primary school teacher, and I was engaged to a police officer, and we'd been together for like maybe 5 or 6 years at that point. Actually, it was 7 when we finally ended it. But I do actually just want to take a quick detour, if that's okay, and speak to something else you just said.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so you mentioned how like the extremes or the polarity of the grief and the joy or the elation, I really like that word, were quite interesting. And I suppose I just want to share with anyone that's listening that what happened was I was living my life in this little spectrum of like I can be this happy and this sad. And because I refused to feel that level of sadness, it was like I couldn't, there was a glass ceiling on my happiness. And then it was like after that, it like blew the container open, and then I could reach like these impossibly blissful states, and at the same time go to these lows that I'd never experienced before. So it's kind of like it just blew open the spectrum of my human experience.
Yeah, wow. So it almost like as if the deeper you could allow yourself to go into the abyss, the more you can allow yourself to feel down below, the more higher you could go.
Yeah, the depth of it created the contrast. And so a lot of people I know, like they start meditation or breathwork and they get really scared because they're like in the beginning, oh, I feel so good. And then, you know, you would have experienced this, Maylene. You hit the dark night or like the place where it starts to feel like maybe there's no meaning to life, or you don't understand, like nightmares or flashbacks or some shit are coming up. And I just really want to speak to it because people at some points people just run away then. But it's the necessary experience that creates the contrast necessary for your evolution.
Yeah, you can't have it's like those two extremes. You can't have love without fear. And then if your understanding of either of those two polarities is only so deep, like you were saying, then you can't expect to progress any more on either side without the other side expanding as well. It's an inevitable eventuation of that exploration.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh, just on that, actually, you got me thinking. So, Burr, with what you're explaining with that necessary descent to be able to then experience a more expanded version of oneself, or whatever that may be, this is something I find that for me personally, perhaps we can read about this and hear about it until the cows come home, but until we feel it in our body, then it's not a reality until we feel it, like you said, viscerally. So is that something that you found that you maybe had heard about and you could understand it intellectually, but it wasn't embodied until that moment?
100%. Yeah, I had intellectualized everything. Like I'm just, because I knew, I'm like, oh, you've got abandonment issues. You know, your mum left when you were a kid. And I was like, oh, you've got a fear of intimacy because of the abuse and you're, and you judge yourself, which is why you're locked in this cycle of overthinking. So,
yeah, cut out just as you were talking about the intellectual.
That's awesome. Well, basically, what I said was the winning strategy that you have for this stage of consciousness, that you had for the previous stage of consciousness, becomes the losing strategy for the next stage. And so, for me, it was the intellectualization of everything, which then had taken me to a point where I could evolve and come to terms with all my issues, but then it became the losing strategy and blocked me from actually having a visceral embodied experience of what needed to transpire in order to be released.
That is so good. Can you repeat that? So the winning strategy for one paradigm becomes a losing strategy for the next one?
Yes, 100%.
That's excellent. That's such good advice. Can you, you were in the middle of a story before you, branched off briefly,
which was a great segue, by the way, thank you.
I actually can't remember what the original question was though.
You were with your previous partner, or you're engaged to a previous partner, and
the cop.
yes
and it was the unfolding of where the unfolding, the becoming of who you are now.
Oh, yeah, okay. So immediately after, like, oh, God, tell this story. Immediately after I left the retreat, I was driving and I was super happy because I was like, finally, I can feel my emotions. Everything is awesome. It was like the Lego movie. And then I was singing Kelly Clarkson while I was driving, and I was like, I'll spread my wings and I'll learn how to fly. And then I had this visceral, again, experience in my heart, and it was like a stab. And and I started to cry again, and I started to say no. And I had this moment where it was like direct. I didn't know what it was back then, but it was a direct message from my body, from the universe. You can't marry this man. And it was so heartbreaking because I was like on the way home to him. I was like so excited. I was like, oh, I haven't seen him for 10 days. Yay. And then I got that message and I just broke down. It like tore me apart. I called my friend and I was like, it was really not funny at the time, but I was in hysterics and I was like, I don't know what's happening. I'm gonna end it with, I'm not gonna say his name, I'm gonna end it with XYZ. And she freaked out on the other line because she'd been the one that had recommended me to go to Vipassana. And she was like, what? And she was like, no! It was just crazy. And then she told my other best friend, and they couldn't sleep that night because they were like, what's happened? And then he and I spent like the next 2 years just trying to work it out, basically. And I'll skip over this part because it's not important, but I went on a kind of like a self-exploration of like psychology to see if there was some way I could remedy this feeling of not wanting to be with this man that I loved. And eventually that journey took me to the UK where I ended up in another relationship. That was really codependent.
Mm-hmm.
And then I really lost a sense of my identity and myself during that time. And Yeah, and I just didn't think that that was possible. I really did not expect to ever feel like I had lost myself so completely through love. I think that was the big piece. It was like, through love. I'm like, what? This doesn't make sense. And so after that, we ended it, and then I went on this huge like personal development journey. So the intellectualization of everything, and it was like I was listening to all my favorite podcasts and presenters and coaches and gurus and all that to try and almost scratch and scrounge back a sense of self-worth. Like, I was like, I can't keep feeling this way. And so I eventually ended up with, well, what made me feel okay? Like last time, it was like meditation. And I'm like, cool. So I never, ever want anybody to go through what I went through, like that depth of like loss of your humanity and then loss of your sense of self. And I was like, cool. So I'm going to bring meditation and make it as commercial as possible so that people actually want to consume it.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Very cool.
I like that your goal was to actively like make it as commercial as possible to make it so accessible for everyone. What is which can, you know, a practice that can be not just maybe a bit abstract or esoteric for some people, but off-putting for some people who have no idea what it is. For people in the you know, our culture today, even though meditation has become quite a popular thing in and of itself, it's still great that people such as yourself are bringing it, making it more available in a more accessible way.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. And
with that commercialization of meditation, what are some of the ways that you're bringing that to people?
Well, it's interesting because the first way I tried was to make the meditation and breathwork classes super scientific.
Ah, yes. Yep.
Mm. And that did not work.
And so what was the motivation behind making it scientific? Was it to make it accessible to the majority of people?
Yeah, it was to make it less esoteric, less woo-woo, to draw people that ordinarily are just so deep in their minds that they can't even conceive of spirituality.
Mm.
But then that didn't work because it was inauthentic to me, I feel. And so then that's when I brought Calmably into the world.
Yeah. And can you give us a time frame? How long ago was this with Calmably?
Oh, probably 2 years ago.
Yeah. And can you please tell our listeners what Calmably is about?
Yeah. Calmably is meditation and yoga with fur babies. So animals that have either been rescued or raised as part of the family, and the whole principle behind it is to allow their presence to shift you into a state of non-judgment and unconditional love. And the greater thing behind it is understanding that when you're meditating or doing yoga with these animals, they're just going to fuck shit up and you've got to let go of your perfect practice.
I see the philosophy behind it.
Because so many people won't go there because they're like, oh no, I'm not good at meditation. And I'm like, neither am I. Like, you never get good at it. You just learn to observe the chaos.
Yeah, that's something that definitely prevents me from continuing in the waves of enthusiasm that I have with meditation. And I hit a point where I feel like, you know, that same kind of thing, that I'm not good at it or I'm not doing it properly. So, and that I think is one of the things that prevents a lot of people from continuing or even trying, because they think, Well, I can't stop my mind from working, so I'm not even going to bother. So can you give some advice or an explanation as to how, like, the process of what someone should expect or how one goes about meditating?
Awesome. So are you, I feel like I don't need to ask this question, but are you a high achiever, Chris? Like, would you say that you just, like, when you do something, you're like, your teeth are in it and you just want to, like, smash it?
You could say that, yes.
Yes. One might say.
One might say yes.
Cool. Okay. So this is why it becomes so difficult for people like you and also like me to meditate. It's because when we start something, we just want to be good at it.
Yeah.
And want to get it perfect and be the best. And meditation is like the opposite of that.
Yeah. I've never thought of it like that.
It's the consistent surrendering to wherever you are, letting go of where you're supposed to be, right? And so for the high achiever, for the person who's super driven, is used to achieving everything, getting everything done perfect, it's like, well there's got to be some kind of external goal that I get to, and then I'll know that I'm doing it right. I'm doing what I need to in order to get the benefit, to reap the benefit of this exercise.
Yeah.
And the meditation is surrendering that and instead just embodying moment to moment exactly how you feel. And so for first timers, it's like, especially for high achievers, they'll sit down, they're like, okay, I'm gonna do like 20 minutes, right? And it's too much.
Yeah.
You gotta, if you're just starting, you start with 5 minutes, because the chaos that's in your mind it just never ends. Insane. We've all been hardwired to constantly be thinking about the next thing that we're going to do in order to get where we're supposed to go, and so it's like, wait a minute, you mean I actually have to sit and do nothing? And on a very, very deep and unconscious level, what's playing out is, if I do nothing, then what do I contribute? And if I'm not contributing, then why do I exist? And if I'm questioning why I exist, am I really worthy of existing?
Yeah.
Maybe I should just die. And it's like, you know, you can go down there, but on surface level, what it will manifest is, I'm really cold, or I'm hungry, or this is stupid, or I'm not good at it, or I need to turn the oven off, or I need to fix all these things on my to-do list. What's that sound? What's that feeling? Is that a bug? Like, all of that is going to come up because the ego or the survival mechanism senses that you're actually about to experience the moment. And that's really scary.
I just got chills. That's, yeah. Yeah, wow.
Like the essence of who you are.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh my God, but what if I'm not actually anything? And then that's where that feeling of like bliss and oneness comes in. It's like, no, you're not. You're not anything. You're everything.
Yeah, that's a really new way to look at it for me. And, you know, that it's kind of like the antithesis of what I feel to be my purpose here. Is that I must be doing something all the time, and to then do the very opposite of that, as you said, it starts to, whether I'm aware of it or not, it will manifest in other ways. But deep down, there's this potentially this stirring of, you're wasting time. You could be doing something else. You could be making. You could be doing. You could be being.
Mm.
Yeah.
You could be serving others.
But with the intellectualization that you've talked about, in contrast with the embodiment, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about how this kind of interacts with leadership So the intellectual leadership and the embodied leadership, are they opposing or can they work together?
Wow, what a great question. Thank you. This is so important right now because all of the forms of leadership are necessary in order to actually lead. We're all required to double down on our natural gifts, but then also exercise whatever's required to get the rest of them up so that we can all interact as like a massive multifunctioning organism. But to speak to like intellectual leadership versus embodied leadership, so intellectual leadership looks like me telling everyone to meditate, but I'm not doing it myself, or me telling everybody, you just need to be with yourself, but I'm like desperate to just serve everybody else, make everyone else feel good. And the issue with intellectualization is that people can feel your truth and your authenticity. They won't know what it is, but if you are intellectualizing your leadership only, then they will feel your inauthenticity and they will follow their feeling over your words. So you might be like, you've just got to, I'll speak to my own experience. If I'm like, oh, you know, make sure that you're willing to give back to yourself at least once a day. And I say that, but then there's like this, there's this ring of falsehood in my voice that the other human can read and pick up on unconsciously. Mm. Consciously, they're like, oh, okay. Unconsciously, there's a part of them that knows that I'm full of shit. Right? And so that's why it's like when we do embodied leadership, it's really powerful because you don't even need to say anything. They can already feel the transmission of your message through the way that you be, or your energetic transmission. So it's like, there is a consistent unfolding when it comes to embodied leadership. Like with intellectualized leadership that is only intellectualized and not embodied, eventually your falsehood will be revealed either from them or through your own imposter syndrome, because you'll have an experience of I'm lying, and that will lower your vibration, your frequency, and it will weaken your immune system, and then it will weaken your ability to transmit anyway, and you'll lose trust and faith in yourself because you're out of integrity. And so you cannot maintain that trajectory of your own leadership because you know it's bullshit. Whereas if it's embodied, it's like I'm in full integrity with myself. So I don't even need to think about what I'm going to say next. I don't even need to know what I'm going to tell you to do because it's just my truth coming out of my mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Forever.
Yes, and how you explain that, it sounds effortless then to be an embodied leader.
Exactly.
And you said the word integrity as well. And when I think of integrity, I think of a person's thoughts aligning with their words, aligning with their actions. And all of that is in alignment. And so I can see here how embodied leadership is such a powerful form of leadership. And it's clear that a person who cultivates embodied leadership is one who is also a practitioner.
Yes. 100%. An embodied leader is someone who's always willing to practice their own leadership and to be the student and be leadable.
That's a really... I never heard it put like that. A lot of explosions going on in my brain here today, Burr. Thank you for that.
you should also get Cody McAuliffe on this podcast because a lot of this stuff I learned from him.
Okay. Cool. All right. The thing that makes me think of is for some time I would watch, you know, people that I'm following, whoever it may be, and they would get up and speak about topics or, you know, they're doing a presentation of some sort. And it's something that I've always gravitated towards, but I had always been very nervous about doing it, making sure that I put all of the content together and then rote learn it over and over and over again to the point where I'd memorize word for word and I would get up and I'd say it like that. And then if someone asked me a question, I'd go, I haven't memorized this answer yet. Because I don't think I knew exactly who I was and who was actually saying these things. I had an idea of who I wanted to be, and I saw my role models who were getting up and speaking in this way. And I'd go, how the fuck do they just get up and talk like this? How are they doing this? How do they know so much stuff? And I would try to emulate that by creating the facade of that I knew what I was talking about. And it's not that I didn't have an interest, or I saw what I wanted to be, but I didn't know who I was to actually get there to be that person. And it's only really very recently that I've started these new projects of mine. And because it's something that I'm so integrated with, and I have that integrity and that embodiment of the thing that I'm getting up and speaking about, I started making videos about the new project that I'm doing, and I didn't write down anything. I just got up and started talking, and then I couldn't stop. I had too much content, and I finally got it. It was like what you said, that the embodiment or the embodied leader or leadership or however you it's called and however it presents for someone, but that embodiment of the thing that they are talking about or that they're preaching, basically. So I can definitely relate to that concept, but I'd not heard it said in such a way.
That's amazing. Thank you so much for sharing that, because I was exactly the same. When I first started with meditation and breathwork, I would memorize and rehearse over and over again everything I was going to say in the introduction, what I was going to say throughout the meditation, and then what I would say at the end.
And
for me, I find that when it's our first time at anything, especially for high achievers, perhaps, is that may be one of those things that we can tend to do, is want to, in our effort to be perfect, we rely more on the tools we know that work. And this is where, for me personally, especially in learning yoga teaching and teaching those classes for the first year, where I would feel like I'd almost shit my pants teaching a class. And I've always been so confident with speaking in public, but the moment I step into a yoga studio, even with 10 people, I'm like, oh my God. And I think because it demanded that I be truthful and be myself. I couldn't have to rehearse a script or anything. And so this is what, for me, the yoga teaching has taught me. It was never about me teaching anything. It had to teach me, for at least the first year anyway, to be myself, to be okay with what comes out of my mouth in the moment, and to trust that. So I totally get what you two are saying in that regard.
Yeah, 100%. I think it's so, it's so much more intense when the gift you're giving is literally just you and your authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's something that you're really big on with sharing with others, Burr, is that I know that you've said before that being yourself really is the only skill you'll ever need. And so in saying that, being yourself as a skill, that says to me that if you can get better at being yourself as a skill, that then leads to greater competency, which leads to greater confidence. And I love that we each all have these different ways that we can go about bringing ourselves to all of these different paradigms, whether that is, you know, teaching a new model of reality or offering fur babies in a meditation class or school teaching, which you've done too, or working as a doctor or a lawyer, whatever that may be. The question always arises is how can we bring more of our authentic self into that role? Because they're all ultimately roles that we play. And so, yeah, and so there's that dance of finding that perhaps we can identify with roles a little bit too much versus, and then being aware of that and then understanding, this isn't all who I am. I'm actually so much more than this, and to keep reminding ourselves that. So I want to ask you, Burr, what advice would you give someone who, how do they start to bring more of their authentic selves into their daily life? Someone who's maybe never done meditation before, maybe the term freaks them out, maybe they're just starting on a journey. Like, what would being yourself look like? How does a person start?
Awesome question again. So when someone asks me, well, how do I be myself more? Like, I don't, that I say, like, you know, you've just got to be yourself. And they're like, yeah, but I don't know how. It's because the mind is grasping for a strategy in order to put forward a new persona that is going to still get you liked, attention, acceptance, and love. Does that make sense?
So the mind is grasping for a strategy
in order to put forward an act that you can play out to ensure your success at being yourself. So essentially, in the grasping of how do I be myself, we've already disowned who we truly are, and we're committed to playing out an act or a strategy.
Okay. So
I take from that to be yourself would be to maybe to do nothing, to just, like, in the nothingness you find who you are, because you still, to be yourself, someone thinks they still have to do something to make that happen.
100%, that's it. So if you're still trying to do being yourself, you're already losing. Essentially, and how you be yourself is to stop trying and moment to moment follow what you want with the willingness to make mistakes and be spontaneous.
Okay, so what I get from that is in the letting go of the doing, of the trying to be oneself, could a person look at, that means then we've all got cues on who we actually are. I mean, what could a person then ask themselves, okay, what do I naturally gravitate towards? You know, if someone's sitting at an office job for 10 hours a day, 5 days a week, but really while they're there, they would rather be, doing martial arts on a beach in Brazil. I don't know. Do you know what I mean? Then maybe there's something in that, there's breadcrumbs in that for them to be more of who they are.
Yes.
So yes. Could it be that a person could invite themselves to look at the cues that they already have in their own life?
Great. Pick up. So a cue is kind of like a moment or a feeling of tension around either I'm lying, this doesn't feel good, or I'm being inauthentic. So the problem with authenticity is that it only exists in contrast to inauthenticity. So the moment you remove that, authenticity is not a graspable thing. So if you can locate the moments or the things in your life that aren't true to yourself, then you can immediately start making new ways of being that allow you to step into your true self. So it's like, okay, like, did I just lie about something? Am I omitting the truth here? So like for me, that might be like this whole time, like my feet have slowly been losing circulation because they're stuck underneath the mattress of my bed, but I'm trying really hard to be grounded even though I'm a little bit nervous. So in that ownership, like, that's me being authentic because I've located a place in me where I'm being inauthentic, which is like I'm just trying to be really cool and like not move, like, so that I look more grounded, more centered, more like what people think a meditation breathwork teacher should look like. My feet are so sore. I can't move them now.
Get those feet out and move them. That's fine. Look, I'll show you my foot. There you go.
Oh, fuck, that's not good.
Oh. Yeah, and I love that. It's really interesting how us humans think that certain things have to look a certain way.
Mm.
Yeah, and that's one thing that I'm really big on is being able to relate to people around us as meditation teachers or any type of teacher. But when we think about it, we have our own teachers as well, and our teachers have their teachers. So it's a whole line of teachers, but it's also a whole line of students as well. And so the ultimate teacher is within each of us.
Yes, 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 yes. Like, and so what I embody at the moment is it's I am a student of life because I can only ever see in you what I require or what I've experienced already, right? So like this whole conversation is teaching me. When I work with my clients, like, they're coaching me. I don't know what I'm going to say. I don't know what needs to be said or heard or felt. It just comes out. And then in that, I have an experience of, oh, cool, this is what I want to do, where I'm supposed to be. And the moment we start thinking I've mastered it all and now I can be the teacher, I don't need to learn anymore, it's the moment that we stop working on what's important to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my Tai Chi teacher that I used to see would always get me to teach other people because it would make me essentially a better student for him. And it was this continuous lineage, and then he would do the same with his teacher. And it wasn't about being, you know, having the power play of being a teacher for somewhere else. That wasn't the point of it. The point of it was that you got better at doing the thing that you're teaching, and that they could be better at as well, and everyone benefits.
Yeah.
As humans, inevitably, there's always the egoic trap of, is the point of being a teacher so that I have students and so that people can follow me? And then some of us, there's always the potential of losing sight of the reason we started doing it in the first place.
Yeah, and I've been through that. I go through that periodically, I would say, because... Do you guys know much about the six human needs?
Is this...
Tony Robbins?
No. Okay, please cool. Explain.
Yeah, please, awesome. Please tell us.
Okay, it's not a massive thing, but he speaks to, we all have six human needs, and if we don't have them all full, then we lack fulfillment in our lives. And so there's things like growth and contribution. So how much are you learning? Are you evolving? Are you changing? And contribution is how much are you giving? How much are you serving? Then there's certainty and uncertainty. So it's like certainty, like, okay, I know my money's going to come at this time. I've got a house, I've got a family, I have certainty, I'm safe. But then it's like, if I don't have any uncertainty, I get bored as fuck. So I need to like create, like, you know, going on roller coasters changing career. And if I have too much uncertainty, well, then I just always feel unsafe and I'm never grounded and life is hell, essentially. That's why he's like, they've got to be full. And the last ones are significance and connection. Connection is obvious, like love, bonding, and then significance is I'm important and this is why I matter. And so I brought this up because, and I do this to myself, which is why I'm speaking to it, like we all need to feel very significant and connected. And if we're missing one or the other, we feel kind of empty. Like, And I've been there. I've been to like the extremes of like the only thing that matters in my life is my relationships and how I'm serving. But then I was just like not, I have no other purpose in the world except to make other people feel good. Mm-hmm. And so I also had an extreme sense of worthlessness.
Mm-hmm.
But then it switched, and especially with Karma Bleed, my significance was like, whoo, like suddenly I'm like in the media and all this stuff. So I was like, oh yeah, I'm the shit. I met it, you know, but then that took over my life and I was really lacking like time and energy to see my friends, to be with my family, to like have a boyfriend even. And so I was just like so empty in my connection cup that like my whole life began to feel kind of empty.
Mm.
And yeah, and like you said, it is, there is the trap of like, I can just begin to do this kind of work so that I feel like important, or like something I like to talk about is the Messiah complex, which occasionally I will go into again. It's like, I've got to save everyone. I'm here to save the world and heal like, you know, all women and all their ancestral lineage and all this crazy shit. But it's like, no, man, you're just here to heal you. And through that embodiment, everybody else is going to get what they need. Trust.
Yeah. I can definitely relate with the messianic complex aspect of life. And I think that's something that's inherent in all of us to keep us going, but also like we all have elements of all of the greatest spiritual teachers. And I think that's why, you know, going back to what Maylene was, what you were saying before about archetypes, I believe we all have the capacity to be, you know, Jesus Christ or Mother Mary or Mother Teresa or whoever we want to, Gandhi or whoever we want to speak about. We have those people inside us. And then when we have moments in our life that kind of ingratiate our ego, or psychedelic experiences do it as well in a very quick and heavy way, but you end up in these points where you go, hang on, I am Jesus, that's the answer. And because we have this whether it's a psychedelic experience or a point where you get to in your life where you people are starting to put you on a pedestal and your ego is inflated because of it, then we take that beaming light of that iconic figure and go, well, I clearly must be that person because they're all responding in this way. And we lose sight of the fact that it's not that we are that person, we just are all imbued with the capabilities of that person because that's who we are as humans. We all have the capacity to, well, we are all an extension of God in however you way you want to see that. And it's about understanding that to say I am God does not mean that, you know, I am the almighty powerful, but rather that I am part of God and so is everyone else. I don't know how I got onto that.
Doesn't matter.
But anyway, segue.
Yeah.
No, that's it though. Because we are.
Yeah.
We are God. And each of us have our own little universe. And once you have that embodied experience of being God, you realize that, like, you being sacred and special and important is humbling. Because if you make everyone else sacred and special and important, like that little baby that gets born hasn't done anything, but you love it anyway, unconditionally. Like, if everybody else gets that treatment and you don't give yourself that treatment, then what are you saying? Everyone's like this, but spiritually you're different. So it is. It's like, yeah, we're all God. We're all perfect.
Yeah. And you're absolutely right. If that's the case, and if we have those moments of that self-realization, it's our challenge as humans in that we feel that the expansiveness of that unconditional love for all things in the moment that we feel it. But because things go in waves, when the wave dips back down and we lose the intensity of that experience, we lose connection somewhat to the feeling that it gave us, and it makes it more difficult for us to then apply that unconditional love to other people in our lives. And it goes back to that, what Mei-Ling was saying before about you can be told something 1,000 times and until you feel it, it means nothing. So yeah, it's an interesting experience being a human, I guess is the sum total of my, summary of it.
I feel like we have moved exclusively into talking about psychedelic experience. What's happening?
No. Yeah, I only said that once or twice.
No, but I know exactly what you're talking about, that oneness that you experience. Yeah.
Well, that would be a good segue into breath work that you do. Can you give us a bit of a rundown about that before we start to wrap up?
Yeah, so the breathwork I do is similar to Wim Hof. It's not his though. And essentially what we're doing is flooding the entire system with oxygen so that we go into over-oxygenation, which deprives certain parts of the brain of energy. And then that allows us to deactivate. Well, let's go. Okay, so the brain is like lizard brain, you know, the instincts of sex, sleep, and hunger, and then it goes into the mammal brain, which is the limbic system, or our capacity to feel emotion. And then the last way that the brain evolved was the cerebral cortex, the thinking part. And so when the brain gets deprived of oxygen, the most sensitive parts of it will switch off. And because it's the youngest, the cerebral cortex, it just goes and goes offline. Mm-hmm. And then that's why you can like pop into states of actual being just with your emotions or just with your pure instincts. Mm. And so, yeah, it can definitely allow you to go beyond your mind into the next dimension, into the astral plane, because you're altering your oxygen and CO2. And this is where it gets really esoteric. And that combined with your complete presence with every breath, because it's not gentle. It's like it's quiet, it's work. It's like called breath work. It's not like breath lounge, breath work. And it requires you to consistently show up over and over again for like 30 minutes or however long with every breath, and you have to consistently let go of what's going to happen, what's next, and just be with this. And it's like this, 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 and then eventually you pop and you just
wow. Is this what's called holotropic breath work?
Yeah, very similar. Yeah. Holotropic is a very specific kind by Stan Grof, and that goes
yes, of course.
Yes. So that's different to mine, because mine will only go for about 45 minutes.
Okay.
Did that answer your question?
Yes, of course. Okay. It'd be bad if I said no, right?
No, it wouldn't. Because I could talk about it for days, but I was like, I'll just speak to the mechanics of it.
Yes, true.
I would like to expand on that and just ask a question. deeper about the breath work, which I find breath work so intriguing. With the breath work, my understanding is that it can allow a person to release repressed or suppressed emotions and, you know, certain types of trauma. On the flip side, could breath work trigger sensations or traumatic responses that can actually re-traumatize a person depending on what's buried in their body? So in saying that, is breath work, you know, suitable for a person who's maybe at a particular stage in their self-awareness? It's just something that I'm curious about, or is there anything that you've personally experienced or observed in others with any trauma that is triggered with breath work?
There's so much more to this question. Can it re-traumatize? Is that the question?
Yeah, that's, could that happen? Could breath work for a certain type of person who maybe has experienced PTSD of some sort, or could breath work trigger sensations that if a person isn't ready for it, could it re-traumatize them?
Cool. Okay. Got it. So the answer is no. And that's in the context of understanding that the triggering experience, the re-trauma and the reactivation is actually the necessary part of the unfolding healing. So it requires complete faith and trust to surrender it all the way through. And if you run away halfway through that process, then you will get stuck and it will appear like you have been re-traumatized and you're worse off.
That makes sense. Mm. So could it be then that with the breath work, if a person was to try this out and see if it suits where they're at in their healing journey right now, for example, could it be that the first step is to find a breath work guide or teacher who that person feels safe and comfortable with?
Yes, 100%, because like you said, it can bring up a lot of repressed and suppressed stuff, and to not feel safe in that experience is scary, and it can be unnecessarily painful.
I see. So I definitely see how actually one of the core aims of breath work is to trigger suppressed emotions that could be from traumatic experiences. But then the difference here is that the adult can stay present with a childhood experience, for example, meet with it and allow it to arise in a safe environment.
Yes, yes. And it's like the breathwork itself might trigger an experience that the breathwork for you can't resolve. But then it's full trust in following your intuition after that point to go to where the calling is to complete the healing. But some people might have a breathwork experience and then they think that, well, nothing came up in that session, so it didn't work. And then they just go back to their regular lives. They're not listening to their intuition or their heart. There's a calling and it's telling you to go somewhere and do something or be somewhere. And that completes it.
Right. So are you saying that there's a type of integration experience after the actual breathwork session where a person then listens to, you know, their intuition or wherever their internal compass is telling them to go, is telling them to maybe go for a yoga retreat or go spend time with your family member who you've had conflict with, or so it's about following then the breadcrumbs to integrate what came up in the breathwork session.
Yeah. Or even outside of it, because it's like, even with the meditation, sometimes the meditation itself can be just super stressful. And that was me this morning. I just hated life the whole time. Like, when will this end? How has it not been 20 minutes yet? And then I finally got out, and then I had like a huge breakthrough this morning, like massive. I was crying and laughing again. It was like insane. And so what happens is the breathwork and the meditation are almost like an activator.
And I guess that's like any practice, right? Whatever a person chooses to practice, the real practice is in between the sessions rather than the sessions itself. It's the spaces in between. Oh, thank you for sharing that about the breath work. Really important stuff.
Yeah, thank you for asking. Your questions are just insane. I'm like, this is really, it really like brings me to like just it grounds me, and then I'm like, okay, cool, like this is deep.
Well, with someone like you who is such an incredibly resourced woman in terms of what you have experienced and what you and how you connect with others and how you share that with others, I just thought, wow, this is my chance. I'm just going to pull out all these questions because people need to hear this stuff. So thank you. It's so great. Chris, do you have any other questions?
The only question I have is, where can people find you? What websites and social media accounts, and how do people get onto all of the great things that you're doing?
Cool. Okay. So for Calmably, for my like meditation with baby animals events, it's www.calmably.com.au. Mm-hmm. And then for like corporate meditation, it's reconnectmeditation.com.au. But really, if you just want to work with me one-on-one, which is, or in small group coaching, which is so much more what I prefer because of the intimacy and the connection, like essentially I'm just like, I just want to be myself with all my friends who are also being themselves. Like, just friend me on Facebook under Berber and then we'll talk.
Cool. Sounds like a plan. So everybody listening and watching, make sure you get on Facebook right now and find Burr, and she will fill your life with amazing things. Thank you so much for this amazing conversation, Burr. Is there anything else you wanted to add?
Just the trust piece, I think. I know for a lot of us on this journey, including myself, there's so many like ups and downs, and we reflect back on like all the things that we've done, and it can seem like, I shouldn't have done that, or that was the wrong thing to do. But ultimately, the universe only ever gives you the experience that's required to stretch your capacity or your energetic capacity in order to give you what you've asked for. So it's like, if I have a goal to like one day speak, like be on a TED stage and do a speech there, well, it's going to put all these crazy challenges in my way because the universe is like, man, no, you're not ready. Mm-hmm. Like, you've got to fail a few times first. So.
Mm. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing you on that TED stage, and I'm sure it's going to happen. Thanks so much for such an open and upfront conversation, Burr. It's been such a pleasure to have you. And when isolation is finally over, it would be great to have you here in person in the actual studio, and we can do all this again.
Yay! Yes! Full surrender. That sounds awesome. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Maylene. You've been awesome.
Thank you so much.